Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, amid the brutal war in Syria, we analyze the psychology that drives human atrocities and the means to prevent them. But first, in remembrance of the 20th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide, we revisit the tragedy with Senator Romeo Dallaire, who witnessed the atrocities firsthand. Romeo Dallaire was the commander of the United Nations peacekeeping forces in Rwanda and had tried to stop the genocide of Tutsis. He's the author of Shake Hands with the Devil and They Fight Like Soldiers, They Die Like Children. He's also the co-director of The Will to Intervene. General Dallaire, I wonder if we could start with your return to Rwanda. I revisited a talk you gave on the internet where you addressed the Rwandan people and where you apologized for your failures.
In my tour, the 10th anniversary, I said that I would like to stop and speak at a class at University of Butare, the National University. We're doing the trip around the country. When we arrived there, they had to move it to the outside stadium, football stadium. And there was about 7,000 people there. And so I spoke. And one of the things I emphasized, not only the fact that I, as the commander of the mission, failed and my mission failed to protect them and to establish an atmosphere of security, I said the era of the white man coming back to Africa to reestablish security and so on is over. I said the sub-Saharan black African is simply not going to attract the engagement of the developed world, the North, unless there is a self-interest in there, and a country like Rwanda doesn't have that. And I said, you will have to take on, through your organizations like the African Union, the ability to self-protect. As I was saying, the white man is not coming back. The clouds had started to form because it was a rainy season. So in the rainy season, it's lovely sunny, and all of a sudden, boom, clouds appear. And then the next thing you know, downpour. And as I'm saying this, the sky got black, and I had just finished saying it, and this incredible thunder clap just happened. And it reverberated over the corrugated scale roofs of the stadium. And it was an incredible reaction. And it just made such an impact that afterwards so many of them came back and said, even the skies recognized that we were into a new era.
One of the things you said on the video that I did see was you were talking about how the Western world and the United Nations responded to Yugoslavia. Mm-hmm. But not to Rwanda.
Yeah. The video you mentioned, which is also called Shake Hands with the Devil, of my trip back at the 10th anniversary with my wife and rewalking the terrain of the genocide. One of the horrific quandaries in which you find yourself in the field is that you have to operate with what you're given, but you're also conscious of what's going on elsewhere. And as I was fighting to get even a budget, let alone the troops I needed, even getting them food, and then the genocide explodes, and the next thing I know, countries are pulling their troops out, and I'm getting the orders, in fact, to withdraw, which I'm refusing. At the same time, Dayton had happened, and we deployed 67,000 troops in ex-Yugoslavia. And the question is how come I couldn't keep 450 soldiers to provide protection to a small portion of that population, and there were more people killed, injured, internally displaced, refugeed, and raped in 100 days in Rwanda than there was in the 6 years of the Yugoslavian campaign? And so what are the criteria that our political elites use? I think the most pejorative side of that is our populations and citizens let them get away with to decide that they're going to invest massively in a European country that's in internally hemorrhaging, but that sub-Saharan black Africans simply don't count. Not only that, but Yugoslavia has no real significant natural resource. It's just situated in Europe. You sort of say, well, you know, it's there as part of maybe the European security context. In Rwanda, there was nothing there either, but the people didn't at all feel ashamed of saying that, you know, there's nothing in Rwanda. There's no oil, no strategic resource. There's nothing of any value. Anything that's there are human beings, and there's too many of them anyway. And so they use that argument.
Did you actually hear that argument?
No. I was briefed. Nations and powerful nations came in within the first week to do assessments. They sent in a small reconnaissance team to look at the situation and then to be able to go back to their national capitals and then decide whether or not they're going to give the UN any resources. That's where the exercise changed in regards to who really is ultimately responsible. Up until the time that these nation states actually came on the ground and looked at the situation, the UN was running the show, and the UN was providing the information to the Security Council, and they were feeding all the nations and all the national capitals and so on. But when these countries came to Rwanda, looked at it and decided they weren't not going to come in, then that meant that they had decided that they would not provide the UN with the resources it needed to stop the genocide. Then that responsibility of the genocide fell on those nation states. And so ultimately, the culprit, or the ones that are really have blood on their hands, are not necessarily the Secretariat of the UN, nor in the field, although we made mistakes, and of course we have a sense of responsibility, as I do as the mission force commander. But those who deliberately took decisions not to provide the UN with any assets to influence the situation, they're the ones that are to be held accountable for the continuum of the slaughter and ultimately the genocide. And that's every nation state in the world. That's why the subtitle of my book, Shake Hands with the Devil, is The Failure of Humanity in Rwanda. They completely lost their sense of humanity amongst themselves with the slaughter. But the rest of humanity abandoned the Rwandans.
So you named several failures that we have to learn from. The failure in humanity in Rwanda, the failure of humanity in the international community, perhaps it's even a bigger failure in that it's what shapes our considerations. And then it sounds like the institutional failures as well.
It would be just too easy to use the only international body that exists that has the ability to bring nations together and regions of the world together on a variety of subjects. I mean, the UN was founded by those five permanent members essentially to prevent them from going to war with each other. And all the rest of the stuff that's come on since, you know, UNESCO and everything else, UNICEF, have been additions in the maturing of that ability. And peacekeeping only started in 1956 with the concept where belligerents decide that they don't want to fight anymore, and they need a sort of a referee to make sure that people play by the rules as they reestablish them. The concept was based on the fact that nation states would be going after other nation states. And then when the Cold War ended, it found itself all of a sudden facing a whole series of imploding nations and failing states that previously had been held under wraps by the big powers, in fact, mostly the permanent five, who had put a lot of dictators in power and, you know, kept control on these artificial countries that came out of the colonial era. So bingo, they find themselves all of a sudden having to face these catastrophic failures with very, very demanding timelines. There's revolutions, there's assassinations, there's breakdown in social structures, and worse than that, there's massive abuse of human rights. There's a fundamental sort of visceral desire to sort these problems out by actually going at the other ethnicities, tribalism, and religious reasons. So much of that explodes. Didn't come on slowly, it exploded. And it was the Cambodia, it was Somalia, due to famine. You had the Congo that was starting up. And in Central Africa, you had also Burundi that had a coup d'etat, and then Rwanda, which was in a civil war. And on the West Africa, well, you had Sierra Leone that was teetering on war. You had Liberia. I mean, this place was just festering of peoples wanting to sort out what their nation state should be, because they were created in artificial boundaries with no logic at all in their sort of ethnic groups or whatever. The UN all of a sudden faces this, and the international community says, oh, by the by, Cold War is over, peace dividend, we don't need big militaries anymore, we don't have to spend on expensive security systems, life is going to be in a new world order. George Bush Sr. Yeah. said that. And on the contrary, it may have sounded secure up in the northern part in the Europe sort of developed world, at least for a while, until Yugoslavia exploded. The rest of the world was going to hell in a handbasket. And the UN was the only body left to pick up the pieces, didn't have the tools, didn't have the people, didn't have the structure. peacekeeping was a very small little select group of about 13 developed countries that would go in, you know, when nation states were at each other. All of a sudden, what you needed was fighting troops. You needed people who could defend others. And it exploded into something of in the order, by the time I got there in 93, of about 50,000 troops around the world with no equipment, no logistics, and mandates that people were pulling out of the air to try to figure out. I mean, my mandate was establish an atmosphere of security. So you sort of say, okay, I've been 30 years in NATO, and my mandates have been to attack, defend, withdraw, bypass. You know, I've even handled nuclear weapons. All of a sudden, I'm in a developing country in the middle of nowhere, and I'm told to establish an atmosphere of security. And the question is, what does establish mean? Do I defend the country when I'm demobilizing both armies against a third party? How far do I use my troops in using force to establish? And what is an atmosphere of security?
Right.
A police state? No weapons? And so mandates started to come out. No resources came to the UN because at that time, the big powers, in particular the United States, had said, that's it, we're not paying anymore because a lot of this money is wasted. So massive deficits were there. We couldn't get budgets to deploy troops. And the real kicker in this comes from the fact that the developed countries start to do a Pontius Pilate trick on the UN. And what they do is they say, okay, these are all brush wars and these are problems there and so on. There's really nothing in it for us that much. And on top of that, you got Somalia and you got Black Hawk Down, and Bill Clinton gets cold feet and pulls out, or accelerates anyways the pullout. So the world power is not keen on playing in this. And so the UN has to go to developing countries to pick up the slack. And they've got no skills, they've got no equipment, they've got no logistics. And yet the same permanent five are still creating mandates to go into Cambodia and go into Mozambique and in Rwanda. But we don't want you to spend money. We want you to minimum force, minimum capabilities, and get out of there as fast as you can. Well, that abdication by the developed world, the white world in particular, to letting the UN carry the can, established the whole strategic scenario in which ultimately, extremists could thrive because they argued that nobody's really going to come. And that's what these guys did in Rwanda. They developed a genocide plan. I mean, they sat around, they developed a plan right down to every 10 huts in the country. They had lists of every Tutsi, where they were. They had lists of every intermarried couple that existed. And the militia was created out of their youth movement that they trained and armed and equipped, and it was all evolving. We were passing all that information up, and there was nothing coming back because nobody wanted to play in it. Why? Because they were all busy with sort of Cambodia, maybe closing down a bit. We were busy with Haiti that was cranking up, that's close to home, and Yugoslavia was building up. So, hey, Rwanda, who's interested? So from a situation during the Cold War of maybe three or four missions going on at any time, and all of them Chapter 6, non-threatening, we end up by 1993 with 15 UN missions, and all of them are Chapter 7, which means the use of force. The last time they had used a Chapter 7 in the Cold War was Korea. So you can imagine the learning curve, particularly within the UN structure, but also the nations that are trying to fill the void abandoned by developed countries. And abandoned is not a facile statement because when in Rwanda during the genocide, I was able to convince a number of Franco and Anglo-African nations to provide me with the battalions I needed, I couldn't get them there because the developed countries didn't want to give me the strategic lift to move them. And then when we worked out a deal that the developed countries would sort of sponsor a battalion. As an example, the Americans were going to sponsor the Ghanaian battalion. So they needed armored personnel vehicles, they needed radios and machine guns. Out of the thousands of armored vehicles sitting in Germany, doing nothing but rusting, they went into a lengthy negotiation of rental. So the United States rented 50 armored personnel vehicles for $14 million. And it took over a month to negotiate it, let alone get the stuff there, get it painted white, put the radios in it that we were scrounging from somewhere else. It was perverse, absolutely perverse. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, the French are fiddling with the extremists because the French believe that Rwanda is going to turn into an Anglo country because the rebels were Anglophiles. And they thought that the Americans were really trying to muscle into their realm of the Franco-Africa. And so they were supporting
the
one side.
Government.
Yeah. And so you get also a nation, a world power, supporting the extremists to the extent of supporting them that they then convince the UN, which has nothing left. I mean, it's got nothing in the bins. It's got no money.
And what month is this roughly now?
We're now in about the end of May, June. So we're 2 months into the genocide. We've got about 500,000 bodies floating all over the place. And we're close to about 3 million people.
And the French are still supporting the Hutu, knowing that there are 500,000 bodies.
To the extent that they convinced the Security Council that it's unacceptable to continue to see this slaughter going on. Because they all hoped that the thing would end in a couple of weeks, but it didn't. It kept on going because there was nothing to stop them. The French said, we got to stop this. They said, we want a Chapter 7 mission, and we're going to go in with a combined force of Franco-African countries, and we will establish a humanitarian protection zone. So what they do is they bring in about 2,000 French soldiers. Most of them were already in Africa and other areas. And they bring in a platoon from Senegal and a platoon from Mali and a couple others to just sort of give them a color of being a multilateral force. And they come in with Jaguar jets, armored vehicles, heavy guns and so on. And they're not coming in there to establish a humanitarian protection zone. They're coming in for a big fight. And so I end up as a Chapter 6 mission that was a peacekeeping mission, establishing the demilitarized zone between the rebel forces that are advancing and winning and the French forces that are trying to establish a humanitarian protection zone, which really is a zone where the extremists were hiding and rearming. So I'm a UN mission being the patroller and a negotiator between the other UN mission and the rebel force.
You just made me think when you're talking about the rebel forces and Paul Kagame, who I think is still president. Yeah. He's kind of become a Western media darling in a way. Mm. But there's been some talk in certain academic circles that he was leading an equally brutal force and then also shot down the plane of the president, allegedly. Do you think that Paul Kagame is as culpable as, say, the other side?
No, no, and no, and no, in all the questions. There is no doubt that Paul Kagame is ruthless. He grew up in a refugee camp. Their family was thrown out of Rwanda by the Hutu extremists, fought with Museveni to get rid of Idi Amin and Obote, studied here in the United States at Leavenworth, a very effective commander. His officers and NCOs were very effective in the Ugandan army. So they were then under pressure from the Ugandans to get out of Uganda. These refugee camps were creating problems for them. And so they wanted to go back to Rwanda or at least get a Rwandan passport so they can go somewhere else. Rwandans refused and that took off the war. So he's got a big chip on his shoulder on how his family and him, they have been treated and how they find themselves after fighting for the Ugandans being thrown out but not having a place to go. So they take matters in their own hands. So you do have a rebel force, however, that is incredibly disciplined and well-trained and well-motivated and focused and well-led with a political structure that has a very high educated strata to it that has looked at what they want to do should they win the war. On the other side, you've got a government force and a government structure that is torn between extremists and moderates, that is a force that is not well-trained, not well-motivated, that is really nearly decrepit, except for some elite units, and has within it a visceral hatred for the Tutsis that is nurtured by the political elite wing, which is extremist, that is influencing the whole of the structure of not only military, but the gendarmerie and also the public service. So you've got this gang that essentially has said that the only way we're going to be able to keep power, because we've got a dictator here, is by eliminating the opposition. And the peace agreement that was signed in 93 essentially eroded so much of the power of the dictator that they felt that they were in fact vulnerable to being thrown in jail, these extremists. The power struggle was, how do we get rid of the Tutsis in order to sustain power, and can we do it? And their assessment of what the reaction of the international community was is we probably would be able to pull it off. They had seen what had happened in coup d'etat in Burundi in October, and there had been next to no response. And I ended up with 300,000 Burundi refugees and over 40,000 bodies floating in the river. So there was next to no reaction in the international community. They thought that they would be able to pull it off, and so they did it. So there was, on one side, a very structured force with a deliberate aim that they were coming back home and they wanted their share of power. On the other side, you had a gang that had taken power but had sort of languished ineptitude under a dictator, and their structures were riddled by extremist thinking, but also caught up in a quandary because there were moderates also there, particularly in the South, that didn't necessarily agree with what was going on. So the extremists take control and they create a scenario in which they can launch their genocide, and they actually implement it. So a genocide happened. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. No revisionism by academics and all kinds of NGOs that have looked at it. Alison DeForge, even in her work previous to that, recognized that there was a genocide that happened. No problem there. Question is, with that genocide, there was a civil war. So the rebel forces are attacking the government forces. In the nature of civil wars, the general population is not on the sides and watch these soldiers fight. The general population is an instrument of war. And what you do is you create a mass of population in order to be your negotiating base when peace comes or peace agreements or when you have to negotiate. So the extremists decide to move the general population and exterminate the Tutsis as they're doing it. So they move millions of people. And they create fear that permits that movement by the extremist radio station that describes the rebels as demons, that they have long teeth, they even have a tail, they have horns, they eat Hutu babies, and on and on and on and on. And this is a highly illiterate population, and so whatever comes off the radio is nearly the voice of God. Add rape to that, and you have then a nation that is now mobile. With that scenario going on, they are moving massive numbers of people and they're slaughtering. The rebel forces are coming down, and what do they find? Slaughtered family. A lot of these people still had family in Rwanda. Although close to a million Tutsis escaped in 1959-60, close to a million still stayed in Rwanda. So you had at the time about 1.2 million Tutsis in the country, plus those who were mixed marriages. The bulk of them were slaughtered, and they had family in the peripheral areas, and these forces were the sons and daughters of the people who had been thrown out. And so when they're coming down through the villages and they're finding their family slaughtered, what do you think happens? So exactions go on, and they are interestingly structured in as much as Kagame court-martialed and shot soldiers who raped. He also prevented looting from happening, but he also had a strong paranoia on security. And because his force was smaller, much smaller than the other side, and of large territory with vast populations, he wanted to ensure that he had security behind him. And so he conducted a sort of a follow-on in regards to ensuring that there were no extremists left behind as they continued to advance to the country. And so there were exactions done. The scale of that is still up for grabs. How much of that was done? How many of the Hutu officers and families that were slaughtered? How many of the refugees who were Hutu came back and were culled for those who had committed slaughter? And remember, here we have no more government, we've got no more structure. And essentially, to blame a person for having conducted a rape or killing of a neighbor, all you needed was five witnesses. And so there were, yeah, exactions. And the scale is to be questioned. But there's nowhere near the similitude or the link between an actual genocide that would have wiped out the 1.2 million Tutsis and as its aim and then keep control of the country, and the other guy who's coming in and trying to keep control both of his own troops but also of establishing a secure environment, which in the scenarios of civil wars can be horrifically ruthless.
Thank you so much, Senator Dallaire.
Yeah.
It's great to have you with us.
Thank you.
When we come back, understanding the roots of lethal violence and cruelty. Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Although war and armed conflict are declining on a global level, atrocities, cruelty, and lethal violence continue in many parts of the world. What is driving people to commit lethal violence? What justifies human cruelty? And what can bystanders and others do to prevent their continuation? Three experts join us now. Irvin Staub is a professor of psychology at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. His books include The Psychology of Good and Evil, Why Children, Adults, and Groups Help and Harm Others, and Overcoming Evil, Genocide, Violent Conflict, and Terrorism. David Livingston Smith is a professor of philosophy at the University of New England. He's the author of Why We Lie, The Evolutionary Roots of Deception and the Unconscious Mind, and Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. John Cagg also joins us. He is professor of philosophy at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell. He's the author of Neoconservative Images of the United Nations, American Domestic Politics and International Cooperation, and co-author of Philosophical Pragmatism and International Relations. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us. David Livingston Smith, I want to start with you. You have made an assertion in your book, Less Than Human, that really came from Jane Goodall, that human beings are the only animals capable of cruelty. You've agreed with her. What's the evidence?
Well, it's not so much a matter of evidence, although it is partially. It's a matter of how we think about the meaning of cruelty. Of course, all sorts of creatures inflict pain on other creatures. The natural world is a pretty nasty place. But to be cruel, I think you have to know what you're doing in the first instance. That is, you have to have the notion not only of pain, actually, but I think more to the point of harm. So cruelty involves deliberate harm. That is, you have to desire to do harm, and you have to believe that by carrying out a certain set of actions, you will succeed in doing harm. And I don't think any other creature has the cognitive horsepower to engage in that sort of thinking.
You've talked about this process of dehumanization. Is that the connection, the moral disengagement that's involved with that, that then links to cruelty?
Sure. So from the outside, of course, dehumanization results in acts which seem quite cruel. But when we dehumanize others, what's going on is that we exclude them from the universe of moral consideration. We morally disengage from them, as you said. So from the dehumanizer standpoint, I think for the most part, the actions aren't seen as cruel. They're seen rather as morally obligatory.
In other words, you're doing a service in some way.
You're doing a service to humanity from your point of view. If you look at the genocides that have unfolded, say, over the past century and no doubt before then, the perpetrators of genocide and other terrible atrocities typically represent what they're doing in moralistic terms. They're doing the world a service. They're eliminating some evil or giving these monstrous creatures what they deserve.
Sounds like a little bit of a slippery slope no matter what. Irvin Staub, let's bring you in. You've been studying political violence, mass violence for a very long time. You've come up with a whole theory around what goes on for people that this occurs and even a set of conditions. What would you add to this?
Well, it's very true that perpetrators usually see what they do as something positive. Social conditions that are very difficult and conflict between groups are often a starting point. And out of that frequently some vision arises. I call this a destructive ideology in which people try to improve the situation of their group, but they see some other group as standing in the way. And there is an evolution that begins, a social, psychological, behavioral evolution in which people begin to harm these other people. And in the course of that, they change, and the society changes, and new institutions are created. And then it is not only moral exclusion and moral disengagement, but there is a reversal of morality. Killing these people becomes the right thing to do. And the bystanders, people in the society who are neither the perpetrators themselves nor members of the victim group, but are onlookers, and they are often complicit, in part by just simply go along as everything was normal. You know, in Germany, people stopped going to buy things in Jewish stores, they stopped relating to Jewish people, they disengaged from Jewish friends, and in that way, they in a way supported the system, and this encourages perpetrators. And people on the outside are often passive. You know, the United States has been passive in relation to many very horrendous events, including the genocide in Rwanda, where I have been working during the genocide, but afterwards for a number of years on reconciliation. And this passivity allows the unfolding of this evolution, as I was talking about. So in order to prevent these things, it's extremely important for people within a society to become resistant. This is not easy, because in difficult times, or when there is conflict between groups, people need their own groups. So to resist this process, to resist this evolution, to have moral courage to speak out, to have ways to connect with other people and try to do something is very challenging. It's not so challenging for outsiders. They could engage in action relatively early before military action is necessary to stop these processes. But unfortunately, we normally observe, stand by, don't do anything, especially when there is only smoke and no huge fire yet.
I'm going to want to go back to this in just a bit, Ervin Staub, and I'd like to put some hard examples on it. In the current age, for example, what's going on in Syria, like what examples of that may be. Before we go there, though, I wanted to bring John Kagg in to talk about this process of technologizing conflict in a way to try to distance and deal with issues of dehumanization. John Kagg, you've looked specifically at the issue of drone warfare, and you've raised concerns about the impact on both individuals and societies. What do you think those are?
Primary motivation for me to begin thinking about drones occurred about 3 years ago. And an economist actually came up to me and said, do you think that drone warfare constitutes what economists generally know as a moral hazard? In this case, we're talking about the use of drones in targeted killings, primarily in the Pakistan region. I thought about it a little bit, and I thought that she was onto something. A moral hazard is basically a situation in which a party or a person is willing to take on greater risks, primarily moral or practical risks, when they do not have to shoulder the consequences associated with those risks. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought that precision-guided munitions and the U.S. use of unmanned aerial vehicles constitute a moral hazard to the extent that these technologies protect U.S. troops and also limit the cost of war. In a certain respect, this is a good thing, but this is definitely a mixed blessing because it allows policymakers to conduct operations without the standard oversight, and we've seen this with the case of drones, without the oversight that previous wars and very costly wars oftentimes require from their citizenry. As I sort of worked through this problem in 2011 and 2012, more data came in about the way in which the U.S. populace was not actually concerned about what was happening in the tribal regions or with targeted killings. Only 9% disapprove of what's happening with drones in those regions In comparison, 52% of Americans care what happens when it comes to surveillance with drones in the domestic setting. And those numbers sort of shocked me and also resonate closely with the findings that Irvin and David have when it comes to othering a population and then feeling willing to exterminate this population for the sake of humanity. It's a pleasure to talk to both of them about this.
We've got this new technology, and then we've got old technology that we saw, say, in Rwanda. People were up close and personal using every mode of cruelty they could possibly use, machetes and hammers and boiling water and the spread of AIDS, and they made their others suffer. What could the U.S. have done in that circumstance to prevent the genocide? And what could it be doing in today's conflicts? Irvin Staub?
The U.S. could have done many things, and the international community could have done many things. I think, for example, that simply putting some kind of substantial military force on the border of Rwanda could have stopped the genocide. When the RPA, the Tutsi army, that finally stopped the genocide was moving near an area, the killing in that area stopped. They didn't even have to enter that area. Instead, what we did was we sent all Western countries, sent military in there to take out its own citizens and go away, which was basically telling people that they can do whatever they will. Now, what can we do in some other situations? Situations are extremely challenging often, admittedly, especially when you don't act early. So, for example, in the Sudan right now, there are areas, the Blue Nile region and another region, where the government is bombing villages, killing people. There are a huge number of refugees. The Sudanese government doesn't allow humanitarian aid to come in to them, and as a result, there is the danger of starvation. Now, minimally, we should focus the searchlight of the international community on that. Point to it. Talk about it. Sudan has already done many things, and the president of Sudan, Bashir, has been already indicted by the International Criminal Court for human rights violations and genocide. So that makes it more problematic. But nonetheless, people respond to the condemnation and the concern and the attention of the international community, and that's the minimum that we could do. And if that doesn't have effect, at least allowing humanitarian aid, then we could move to other things. You know, we have now an atrocities prevention board that was established last year, I believe, by our president. It was recommended by a commission by Albright and Cohen. It's an interagency board. There is no clear indication of what that board has done since it has been established. Samantha Power was the chair of that board, the head of that board. It would be good to ask her what that board has done and also what that board could do in these situations. Some of them are even more complicated. Syria is more complicated because there are so many elements and so many parties there. But the danger in Syria is that either party, if it wins, there is going to be significant retaliation against the other. Again, great possible cruelty.
David Livingston Smith.
I'd like to, first of all, say thank you, Irvin, for mentioning Sudan. This is one of my big concerns, the situation in Sudan, and I'm continually trying to raise awareness of it. And people seem not to care. The world seems oblivious to the monstrous things going on in that country. It is really a genocide of attrition and a highly racialized genocide, as genocides tend to be, and shot through with dehumanization.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Irvin Staub, David Livingston Smith, and John Kagg about the roots of political violence, the phenomenon of dehumanization, and the process of rehumanization and preventing future political violence. If we wanted to go back into this whole issue of dehumanization and the process of rehumanization, you've kind of made an assertion in your book that you think that there's something very natural and human about clinging to one's own. I wonder if, in fact, it has been socialized and if it can be socialized out by a rehumanization process.
I think it's both. You see, I do think that we have a tendency to privilege our own. But what counts as our own? You see, this is the crucial question. The whole of humanity might count as one's own, or one's members of one's religion might count as one's own, or one's nationality, or one's tribe, or so on. So the boundaries of what you consider your in-group are immensely flexible, and this is a typically human characteristic, which makes it possible both for us to form alliances with others, to include them in our moral universe, but also to exclude them. I see this process of exclusion as the solution to a problem. And the problem is, as soon as we recognize others as fellow human beings, which we are all capable of doing, this activates inhibitions in us, inhibitions against harming them, and certainly against killing them. So that's why, by the way, killing other human beings is, for most people, very difficult. It's not like in the movies. Right, it's psychologically challenging. I was just reading James Dawe's book, Evil Men, and he's speaking to a Japanese veteran of the Nanjing Massacre, and this man was saying they used to do bayonet practice on Chinese people who were tied to trees. So there was no danger to the Japanese recruit. They just had to approach the Chinese person and slip a bayonet into their heart, but they trembled with fear as they did it. This sort of thing is very, very difficult to do. But at the same time, it is obviously advantageous to do violence to others, materially advantageous on occasion. We can steal their stuff. We can enslave them. We can extend our territory and so on. So if you think about that if you think that most normal human beings, psychologically normal beings, have inhibitions against performing these terrible acts, while at the same time these acts are advantageous or they're committed under duress on the part of governments and other powerful elites, then you see people are between a rock and a hard place. And I think that dehumanization is a solution to this problem. If we really conceive of others as subhuman creatures, then we're relieved from the moral burden which would cause us to have difficulty doing harm to them. Now, I said that there's something about dehumanization that comes readily to us, but that doesn't mean that it is not a social and a socialized phenomenon as well. The fact that it comes easily to us has led governments and their propaganda apparatuses to exploit that tendency, to whip up dehumanizing sentiment in order to get people to do things that they want them to do.
John Cagg, how does this fit in with the whole technological aspect?
As Dave is talking, I'm thinking that the way that technology allows modern militaries to kill at a distance allows individuals to take combatants as not genuinely human, but rather as pixelated characters, or in the case of drone operators, for example. What is interesting, however, is that drone operators still recount that they have a great deal of trouble doing the job that they're asked to do. I think that this, however, is going to become worse, not better, when it comes to modern warfare and modern technology, modern military technologies. David began his comments with saying that cruelty is doing something, you have to know what you're doing. And I think that what is necessary, at least in the case of modern military operations, maybe not in the case of genocide in Sudan, for example, but in modern military operations, is to underscore the way that responsibility is something that cannot be gotten around, and that responsibility is not something that you can work into or build into particular autonomous computer systems. This ability to reflect and to claim one's actions as one's own is a sort of precondition for cruelty, but it's also a precondition for morality. And if we are to maintain our moral bearing, I think it's necessary to maintain that warfare is distinctly human, and that technology cannot sort of stand in for our normative judgments. And I think that there's a danger when we say something like drones eliminate collateral damage. We're coming very close to making a sort of category mistake. Technology is not smart. It's not necessarily good just because it's easy to use. And I think that there is the assumption that the mere use of certain types of technologies provide the moral justification for their use. And I think that's very dangerous.
John Kegg, there are a couple of things that you had said in your writing that I wanted to look at. There's something like 30% of them have some kind of psychological burnout, I think is what it was called. They have an existential crisis, I think was in one of your pieces. At the same time, we also know that something like 66% of Americans support this drone warfare overseas. But your concern kind of fit within the context of absolute power and what that does to a society, how it kind of creates a looseness of ethics and legal matters. Do you see that happening now?
Very recently, I think we've seen steps in terms of the drone program. It seems that things are becoming a little more transparent, and I'm very happy about this. But I think that there is still a very great danger that as we acquire more power in terms of technological capabilities, and that technology protects our citizens and citizen soldiers from harm's way, that there's a very real danger that we become alienated from the wars that we are fighting. Immanuel Kant in the late 1700s said that republics were good when it came to peace because their citizens bore some of the brunt of war. And because of this, they would put pressure on their leaders to avoid war. I think that what we found, at least with the recent drone campaigns, is that citizens place pressure on their leaders to protect them, to shield them from the costs of war. But with technology, this does not necessarily mean that this will lead to peaceful outcomes. Rather, it will lead to a type of sanitized war, at least sanitized for our own troops, safe for our own troops. But in no way will it assure peace or peaceful actions around the world. So that's a concern. And perhaps one other statistic is informative. When asked in 2012, a large group of Americans were asked where the majority of drone strikes occurred, only 12% of people got the right answer. So drones and these types of technologies allow a citizenry to, in Irvin's words, to sort of just be bystanders and stand back. And I'm afraid that this will lead to what philosophers typically call the banality of evil, that evil acts are not created by particularly extraordinary ones, but by pathetically ordinary ones, and that the bystanders, as Irvin said, are complicit in the atrocities that go on in their name, but fairly quietly so.
Irvin Staub, I know you're working now and have a forthcoming book that deals with how to bring out sort of the good side of humanity, the moral side, the ethical side. We know from political science and international relations statistics that, in fact, war has diminished. It doesn't look like it when we see the news, but statistically, the numbers have gone down. The number of deaths have gone down, dying in war. So it is improving, but it sure still looks awful. If you were to look now across what we're facing as a humanity, and you've been working with people on the ground, what do you think are the most important things that need to be done?
I think one thing that needs to be done is to bring the humanity of people around the world close to us. As my fellow participants were just saying, technology creates a distance. When we create abstractions out of people, when we talk about thousands, when we look at large numbers, we don't connect to human beings. So how we can humanize the other. One of the important things to prevent violence by one group against another is on a group level to come to see the humanity of the other. In the individual level, some people get involved in violence, in a violent society, and many others don't. And the people who do get involved have certain characteristics. We can raise children in ways that they develop what I call inclusive caring. Many people want their children to care about the welfare of others, but limit that caring to people within the family or within their religious group or within their ethnic groups, maybe within their nation. But don't expand it beyond certain borders. And we actually train children that some people, caring should not apply to certain people because they don't deserve it. So there are socialization practices, there are experiences in the family, there are experiences in the school, there are ways that children can be helped to connect with each other that can all develop this inclusive caring and also can develop moral courage. The morality and the caring that leads to the willingness to speak up and take action when other people are harmed, even in the face of opposition, even in the face of people in the environment who go along with that. So that moral courage, there is no research about courage in general. A lot of it is military people of different kinds. That shows that training and experience in being involved in courageous activities can increase courage. Children are often not encouraged to speak out, to take action that may lead their peers to not like them, that may say something to their teachers, that can have potentially negative consequences, even if these are morally relevant, important issues. We can actually help children to develop their voice, to develop their belief that it is okay to express what they think in positive ways and to be morally courageous. And so through that, we are likely to create active bystandership that can move upward and influence people in positions of power. The trouble is that very often when people are in positions of influence and power and they have certain ideologies and they follow a leader, their moral values can be subverted by the pressures and influences within their circumstances. And instead, some other things like loyalty and obedience and a shared cause become extremely important for them. By raising children in ways, in families, in communities, in churches, and all kinds of places, that they are becoming the kind of people who can resist this subversion of their morality. When they get into positions of influence and power, we are likely to have better leadership. We are likely to have a better country.
Ervin Staub, I know you yourself are a Holocaust survivor. I also know that so many people in those situations where there is a culture of violence and a culture of cruelty, when they speak out, they don't often survive. Take Syria, for example, right now. It looks from here like a spree of killing on both sides.
Yes, there is a spree of killing. And Syria has become a situation that is extremely complex, extremely dangerous. And truthfully, it's very difficult to know what to do. If I was in a position of power, I would certainly work towards some kind of action. Maybe the action would simply be as a start to stop overflights so that the various groups cannot simply bomb from the air. But it is very challenging. But active bystandership is often challenging. You know, we have all kinds of heroes who make a difference coming back home. Many people don't know the name of Ron Reidauer. Ron Reidauer was a man who served in Vietnam. He was not at My Lai, where, as most people know, 300 to 500 people were killed, not fighters, villagers, civilians, women, children, and old men, by our troops. And Ron Reidauer trained with soldiers who were at My Lai, and he heard about this. And he couldn't stop until he made it sure that our country knew about this. He was the man through whom congressional investigations began, and Seymour Hersh started to write about it, and the country came to know about it. This was very unpopular. His fellow soldiers didn't like it, but he did what his conscience committed him to do, and as a result, there were less of these things happening later on, for sure. So the point is, I agree with you that these things are not easy to do. They can be dangerous. But if people act early, if they use their own mind and they process what is going on and make judgments about events and manage together with other people, and hopefully these are you know, we are talking about governments also, manage to act early, the danger is less.
David Livingston Smith.
Of course, I can't disagree with what Irvin just said. No sane person could disagree with that. However, there is a complication. As we've noted already, we've both agreed, people who commit these atrocious acts often take themselves to be morally righteous and take themselves to be displaying moral courage. Heinrich Himmler, in his infamous Poznan speech, conveyed this, you know, very, very clearly. What we need to do, I think, and this connects with what John Kagg said, is to work against those processes by means of which human beings override their inhibitions against lethal violence. That is, we need to be intolerant, and this is actually a responsibility, I think, very much of the media. We need to be intolerant of dehumanizing rhetoric and other forms of speech and thought which make it easy for us not to care, to neglect the humanity of others, and indeed make it easy for us to inflict terrible harm on them.
John Kagg.
Very quickly, I'll follow up on David's point. I think that in our culture, it's very easy to think about goodness as being synonymous with easiness. And I think that what has come across through David and Irving's comments is that the good and the moral and the just is not easy. And that is something that I think is a fact that is going to run counter to our deepest intuitions, because we would like things to be easy, but that does not always mean that they are good. And in fact, the easiness of some act is oftentimes the sign that we have gone off the tracks, morally speaking, in a fairly dramatic sense.
Thank you very much for your very profound comments. Really appreciate you joining us and sharing your thinking and your research and logic with us. Irvin Staub, David Livingston Smith, John Kagg, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Irvin Staub is a professor of psychology at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. His books include The Psychology of Good and Evil, Why Children, Adults, and Groups Help and Harm Others, and Overcoming Evil, Genocide, Violent Conflict, and Terrorism. David Livingston Smith is a professor of philosophy at the University of New England. He's the author of Why We Lie, The Evolutionary Roots of Deception and the Unconscious Mind, and Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. John Kagg is professor of philosophy at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell. He's the author of Neoconservative Images of the United Nations, American Domestic Politics and International Cooperation, and co-author of Philosophical Pragmatism and International Relations. Thanks to all who made this program possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Sad Dongre, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of the show, you can find our archives at scholarscircle.org. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Armudian. See you next week.